Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's September 21st. Let's see if I can get some other lights on here. I think I like it like that best. Okay, and we're scheduled to have a test on the 30th of September, so that's about a week and a half away. Got three lectures, and exam two is going to cover chapters 4, 5, and 7, not 9, okay, because there's just no way we can get through 9. It's not a terribly long chapter, but we'll have to put that on the next test, nonetheless. Okay, so we're going to finish up cell respiration and move on to a nervous system today. The information changes a little bit. So when we get to nervous system, it's going to be more biology and maybe less chemistry, but you're going to be using some of the chemical principles that we've learned for the nervous system, nonetheless. So it's, knowing your chemistry is still a really good idea. All right, so we talked about, that's what I want to put over here. Okay, what do I want to put over here? I want to put a picture of this thing. Might be too late already. All right, if I need it, I'll just have to come back to it. I actually can't come back to it. We got to start right here. All right, so we spent about a day. We looked at glycolysis. And the best way to think of glycolysis is what? Glucose splitting it into pyruvate. And that's an exergonic reaction, so your cells can use some of that energy that's released to make ATP. And how is ATP made? There's two different ways that a cell can make ATP. One is in the cytosol, okay, and another is by using the electron transport chain. And since glycolysis is in the cytosol, how would we characterize this way of making ATP? Okay, anaerobic, I kind of like that, right? But the term I was really thinking of is substrate-level phosphorylation. Substrate-level phosphorylation makes ATP via glycolysis, okay? And, right, then pyruvic acid goes into the mitochondria under aerobic conditions, and there's a preparatory reaction that makes some NADH, but then that acetyl-CoA goes into the Krebs cycle, and the Krebs cycle, for every turn, makes an ATP as well. Okay, and I would like for you to know how that ATP is made. How would you characterize the production of ATP by the Krebs cycle? Not via NADH or FADH2, but just the synthesis of ATP in the Krebs cycle. Again, that is what we call substrate-level phosphorylation. It's just due to an enzymatic reaction, okay, in one of the steps of the Krebs cycle. And, of course, that happens under aerobic conditions because pyruvic acid doesn't even enter the mitochondria otherwise. All right, there's another high-energy intermediate that is a cofactor. No, I'm sorry, that is a coenzyme. All right, it's going to donate something to the electron transport chain. And glycolysis produces some of this coenzyme. The preparatory reaction produces some of this coenzyme, and the Krebs cycle produces some of this coenzyme as well. It's donating something, and we call it a coenzyme because it's transferring something from one set of chemical reactions to another. So these things are coming from glycolysis, the prep reaction, and the Krebs cycle, and they're all carrying something to the electron transport chain. And the molecule I'm thinking of is NADH, right? NADH is carrying high energy electrons to the electron transport chain, right? But how many times does the Krebs cycle turn for every glucose? Two, right? And that's because why? Because glucose is split into two pyruvic acids, right? Or two pyruvates, right? So I think we were just beginning to talk about how NADH transfers some of these high-energy electrons to the electron transport chain and where they are located. All right, so we are in the mitochondria. The electron transport chain is a number of biochemicals that are embedded in the inner membrane of the mitochondria. All right, so the Krebs cycle is taking place in the matrix of the mitochondria. That's the innermost compartment. And Let's just jump to then kind of the tail end of this chapter over here. Oh, good, here. Here we are. All right, so there's Krebs cycle. Here's the electron transport chain. And the major component within the electron transport chain are what we call cytochromes. There's some other coenzymes involved, like coenzyme Q and FMN, but mostly we see that there are different kinds of cytochromes, and cytochromes can undergo oxidation-reduction reactions. All right, so electrons can flow from coenzyme Q into cytochrome B, and when it does, that reduces cytochrome B, then cytochrome B can transfer electrons to cytochrome C1, and what happens to cytochrome B when C1 receives those electrons? Yeah, it becomes oxidized, right, and then C1 becomes reduced, and then C1 can transfer electrons to C, and then finally to cytochrome A, and then finally to cytochrome A3. So these are just a series of oxidation-reduction reactions, and as these electrons flow through these various membrane components, from this slide right here, we should see that protons are pumped into the intermembrane space right here. So as electrons flow, there's a huge gradient of protons from a high concentration in the intermembrane space to low concentration in the matrix in this area. So there are three of these pumps that become activated when NADH releases electrons to the first pump. But remember, FADH2 releases electrons at a little bit lower energy level, so there are only two pumps that are activated by FADH2. All right, so now you have a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, low concentration in the matrix, and when you have a concentration gradient of something, whether it's a concentration of sodium, a concentration gradient of sodium, or maybe a concentration gradient of electrical charge, what is that really? A gradient is, even think of a battery. A battery is producing a gradient of electrical charge from one terminal to another. What do you have in a battery if it's charged? You have energy, so you can power electrical equipment with it, and this mitochondria right here can actually power this device right here. All right, it's because protons are going to want to flow from high concentration to low, right? And so there is energy in that flow of protons back down into the matrix. They can't flow through these pumps right here, but they flow through this respiratory assembly. And the respiratory assembly has two parts to it. There is a proton channel, and then there, a couple to that is an ATP synthase or an ATP synthetase enzyme. So when protons flow back into the matrix, right, the synthetase will take an ADP and an inorganic phosphate and produce ATP when they flow down. All right, so that concentration gradient is the energy source for making ATP, and we call that the chemiosmotic theory on how mitochondria can make so many ATP. All right, but don't forget, these electrons have to flow through electron transport, because if one of the cytochromes can no longer be oxidized by giving up electrons, then it can't be reduced again, right? And if it can't be reduced again, then electrons can't flow from one compound to another. So these electrons have to end up someplace, and they have to be moved out of your body. And so you should know what is the final electron acceptor that mitochondria use to keep the electron transport chain operating. And that is oxygen that we see right here, right? So we take oxygen and some protons, and in this last step right here, that produces water, and that keeps the electron transport chain operating, right? Pumping protons, and then this respiratory assembly right here can make ATP. Okay, so it's important for you to know that concentration gradient is powering this respiratory assembly on the inner mitochondrial membrane. All right, so this process of making ATP inside the mitochondria is not substrate-level phosphorylation, like we find in the Krebs cycle and find in glycolysis. This is what we call oxidative phosphorylation, because it requires this oxygen to accept those electrons that are moving through ETC. So there are two main ways that a cell can make ATP. One is substrate-level, and the other is oxidative phosphorylation, substrate-level phosphorylation versus oxidative phosphorylation. Okay. So you should just kind of break that down in your mind and remember where substrate level phosphorylation takes place. Okay, that happens in glycolysis and also in the Krebs cycle. One can be under anaerobic conditions, but the Krebs cycle has to operate only under aerobic conditions. And of course, oxidative phosphorylation, on the other hand, operates only under aerobic conditions as well. All right, so we do want to make a synopsis of how many ATPs are produced for these various coenzymes, because probably what I'm going to say in lecture is a little bit different than in the book. Okay, so every NADH is carrying a pair of electrons, and what I want you to just make note of is, let's just say that for every NADH that's in the mitochondria can make 3 ATP. And can you picture that chemiasmotic diagram? How many proton pumps were in that membrane? Yeah, 3. So that's an easy way just to match up your understanding, right? But FADH2 only produces 2 ATP because it's at a lower energy level. All right, so now your book says that this is the theoretical maximum of ATP that is produced. All right, and that's really what I want you to remember. But then the book further goes on and says, well, the real amount of ATP produced by an NADH in the mitochondria is really 2.5. And for FADH2, it's really 1.5. Well, that's really nice to know that in real-world circumstances, there might be some losses in the production of ATP, but I think it's fine in this class if you just know the theoretical maximum yield of ATP for every NADH and FADH2, and that's 3 and 2, okay? And under different kinds of cellular conditions, then that number is going to change, right? It might drop down for NADH, it might drop down to 2.5 or 2.4 or 2.3 or 2.1 or whatever, but scientists will be talking about that for the next 100 years, right? So let's just define it right here now, 3 and 2 for ATP synthesis. Okay, so this is a pretty good table right here that you should be aware of. And here you can see those these numbers in the very last column that show the maybe how ATP is synthesized under actual conditions as opposed to the theoretical maximum right here. All right, so if you have glucose going to pyruvate, of course, the net gain of ATP is 2. And how is that ATP synthesized? What kind of process? What kind of phosphorylation? Substrate level phosphorylation. That's right, it's not oxidative. All right, but glycolysis also produces 2 NADHs. Okay, so that ATP made by oxidative phosphorylation when these NADHs move into the mitochondria, because remember, where is glycolysis taking place? In the cytoplasm, all right? But oxidative phosphorylation takes place in the mitochondria, so those glycolytic NADHs that are made have to move into the mitochondria, and there is a cost to moving them into the mitochondria, which costs some ATP. So NADH goes through the membrane, right? The energies, these electrons, are transferred to FADH2 inside the mitochondria. And so what I want you to know, these FADH2 can make 2 ATPs, right, for each of them instead of 3. So, right, so you should have 2 ATP per FADH2 times 2. So that should actually be, what, 4 right here, for the theoretical maximum limit. All right, so this might seem just a little complicated, but then I'll tell you what I want you to know for the overall reaction in just a little bit. All right, then we got the preparatory reaction, right? Pyruvate being decarboxylated into acetyl-CoA. There are 2 for every glucose, all right? And there is no substrate level phosphorylation taking place in that step at all, but there is what? An NADH that's being made. And this reaction takes place in the mitochondria, right? So there's 2 of those. So we get 2 NADHs, one from each pyruvic acid being turned into acetyl-CoA. And so that would be 3 ATP per NADH times 2. So that would be 6 right here. All right, then the Krebs cycle. Can you picture the Krebs cycle? What's happening there? couple different kinds of energy molecules being produced. You've got ATP, well, you got GTP, which then gets converted to ATP via what kind of phosphorylation? Substrate level phosphorylation once again. Okay, but the Krebs cycle also produces some of these coenzymes. It produces three NADHs, and it produces an FADH2. This energy is not lost, because where does the Krebs cycle take place? In the mitochondria. So there's no cost to importing these NADHs and FADH2s into the mitochondria, because that's where they're being produced. All right, so there's three of these, all right, times three ATP. All right, so that should be nine. And then two ATPs for every DH2, and there are two of those, right, because the Krebs cycle goes around twice for every glucose molecule. All right, so that would be four in that location. So if we add all of these ATPs up for the theoretical maximum yield, depending on the conditions, right, you would expect to see somewhere between 36 and 38 ATP made from every glucose when it is completely metabolized by aerobic respiration. All right, so just jot down 30-something, okay? And this number is close. This is 30, so this might be under certain conditions that the cell is facing. Okay, 36 to 38. Now, what about anaerobic conditions? How many ATP can be made for every glucose under anaerobic conditions? Okay, so hopefully, do you know where that's taking place? The metabolic pathway, that's just glycolysis, right? So glycolysis makes 4 ATP, but it takes 2 to get glycolysis started. So glycolysis will only produce 2 ATP. So the comparison I want you to make of aerobic respiration versus anaerobic respiration is, aerobic is 30-something ATP, maybe as much as 38 under ideal conditions, and anaerobic respiration will make a measly 2. All right, so for highly metabolic organs like brain, kidney, heart, organs like that, they rely on aerobic respiration to meet their needs of ATP. Anaerobic respiration can't supply enough ATP, and indeed those tissues will die unless they can operate aerobically. All right, so I'm not so concerned in this class if you know that for every glucose there's 30 ATP or 31 or 36, but I want you to know the comparison between aerobic and anaerobic, which is what, 30-something versus 2. Okay, that's the big concern. But you should have a feel for how energy flows through the preparatory reaction in the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain. Okay, and have a really good feel for that chemiosmotic theory. All right, so this indeed is a good exam figure right here. And something about this terminal electron acceptor and how important that is. And you should know something about this respiratory assembly as well. Okay, so this process happens under aerobic conditions when there is oxygen present, but every once in a while somebody might suffer a stroke, for instance, or a heart attack, and blood supply to an organ is cut off and that organ no longer has oxygen. And I want to say something about mitochondria that we don't really know how to use clinically yet, but maybe in your lifetimes it might become very, very important. Okay, so here we are. What organelle are we in right here? Mitochondria, right? Okay, and these mitochondria need oxygen and they produce ATP for us. All right, but under anaerobic conditions, there is no oxygen right here. The mitochondria still want to, by their nature, make sure that the intermembrane space is high in protons compared to the matrix right here. But since these electrons can't flow through the electron transport chain, mitochondria can't pump these protons into the intermembrane space, and there is another way of doing it, and it has to do this with this respiratory assembly right here. Under anaerobic conditions, the mitochondria can take this respiratory assembly and make the protons run in the reverse direction. It can make this thing run backwards. Now, what's the consequence? It can make this ATP synthase run backwards, but what's the consequence for making this respiratory assembly run backwards under anaerobic conditions? To maintain a high proton concentration in the intermembrane space. Can you see what happens? Yeah, it runs this reaction backwards. So mitochondria under anaerobic conditions actually do what? Use up ATP to the detriment of the cell, to the detriment of the organism. Okay, and so sometime we might figure out a way when somebody is suffering a stroke or heart attack or something to somehow regulate this respiratory assembly right here so that mitochondria don't use up that valuable ATP, and that might provide some living space for a person until they can reestablish blood flow to a brain or to a heart until they can revascularize. So under anaerobic conditions, mitochondria aren't really helping us, and indeed they actually might help hasten the demise of the cells that they're actually in, which is kind of interesting. Okay. Well, there are other ways that your body can make ATP through fat and protein metabolism. We're going to look at some fat metabolism, okay, not too much in the way of protein metabolism. And a fat in particular, I'm thinking about triglycerides, can be broken down or hydrolyzed into glycerol and fatty acids. As a matter of fact, how many fatty acids?
Three
fatty acids. And those fatty acids then can, with some modification, they can be broken down, but when they're broken down, they can be run through the Krebs cycle to make some ATP through substrate level phosphorylation, as well as some coenzymes like NADH and FADH2, and produce ATP. All right, and some of these other reactions can also interconvert various kinds of compounds in our body, like fats into proteins into fats, and proteins into carbohydrates, and to some extent vice versa. So let's take a look at some of this right here. This right here might be an exam figure, I can't remember. Okay, but you should recognize that we have glucose up over here, which is a little bit off the screen. And then we have glucose running down to pyruvic acid. So what would we call this process right here? Yeah, this is glycolysis, right? That's just your simple glycolysis. And one of the intermediate steps of glycolysis is this three-carbon fragment, which can be converted into glycerol, which is what, a building block of a triglyceride. Okay, then pyruvic acid, once it enters the mitochondria, it becomes decarboxylated. It becomes that acetyl group that has a two-carbon group to it. All right, and that can run through the Krebs cycle and, of course, produce a lot of ATP via substrate level and oxidative phosphorylation, both of those processes. Remember, fatty acids are very long-chain hydrocarbons. And the way fatty acids are broken down, they're broken down two carbon fragments at a time, right? And that becomes acetyl-CoA. And then that acetyl-CoA from the fatty acid can run through the Krebs cycle to produce a lot of energy. So two carbon fragments at a time. When you look at this diagram, a lot of these steps you see have two arrows associated with them. All right, so glycolysis has the blue arrows pointing down, and then it has these other dotted arrows pointing up. And what would you call this process of these non-sugar molecules, like pyruvic acid being used to make glucose? That is gluconeogenesis. So gluconeogenesis can happen even as far away as the pyruvate molecule right here. But what about this step between pyruvic acid and acetyl-CoA? Which direction do you see that arrow? Only one way, right? So a two-carbon fragment in our bodies can never be used to make sugar, okay, because it can't overcome this step right here. That's a decarboxylation step. So this just means that any time you have fat in your body, all right, it can only be used, or these fatty acids can only be used to make a triglyceride, or it can be used to make energy through oxidative phosphorylation. That's really pretty much the only fate for this acetyl-CoA right here. Right, you can't make sugars out of it as a result. All right, so let's take a look at this. So acetyl-CoA, it's a two-carbon unit. It can be used to make energy versus the Krebs cycle, and that goes into CO2. And this acetyl-CoA then is really trapped in lipid. It can be used to make cholesterol, which is what kind of compound? It's a steroid, but in particular, is it a protein or lipid or carbohydrate? It's a lipid, okay? And a fatty acid is a lipid. And then there are some other related compounds right here that are called ketone bodies. All right, so this acetyl-CoA really can't be used to make sugar anymore. All right. And that's because it is just made out of two carbon atoms. All right, so there is a beverage that people like to drink frequently, which is ethyl alcohol. And I don't know if you remember how many I drew it on the board a couple times ago, and how many carbon atoms are there in ethyl alcohol? There are actually two. Ethyl alcohol has two carbon atoms, okay? And because of that, right, it's related to this acetyl group, because this acetate group has two carbon atoms, the fate for ethyl alcohol pretty much is the same as this acetyl group. It can be used to make cholesterol or fatty acids, but the alcohol that we drink really can't be used to make proteins or sugars or nucleic acids like that. So actually, when you drink alcohol, how does your body have to deal with it? Alcohol is really dealt with like a fat. So when you drink alcohol, it's like eating a bar of butter. Okay, and that is why it is so, one of the reasons why it's so toxic to the liver, because it just overloads a person's liver with fat. And I've known people really to kill themselves, give themselves liver cirrhosis just by having a couple beers every day, day after day after day after day. A couple beers, you know, every once in a while is fine. Six pack maybe every once in a while is fine, but day after day after day, right, your liver just loads up with fat. And you lose the function of the liver as a result of that. Okay, lipogenesis is just the production of triglycerides from fatty acids and glycerol. All right, fatty acids right here are made from acetyl-CoA. Where do we have this, right? Acetyl-CoA can be used to make fatty acids, and then you need a glycerol from glycolysis to make fat. And fat is just a very nice medium for storing energy. There are 9 kilocalories of energy per gram of fat, but for carbohydrates and proteins, it's only 4 kilocalories per gram, right? So there's a lot of energy in fat, and that's why it's such a very nice storage medium for energy. Lipolysis is the reverse of lipogenesis, and so it's the breakdown of fat, and you should probably write down triglycerides into fatty acids and glycerol. And that's just a hydrolysis reaction by lipase. Okay? And then those fatty acids can be used to produce acetyl-CoAs to be put through the Krebs cycle. Right? But that's not really lipolysis. So I do want to talk about that reaction. Okay? And that reaction is what we call beta oxidation. Beta oxidation. And so here we have a fatty acid. This is a long chain hydrocarbon, and this might have as many as 20 or 26 carbon units, right? So it's a really, really long one. We don't print the whole thing out. And then on the very tail end, there is a carboxyl group, and this is the working end for beta oxidation. This is where we start. So the first step for beta oxidation is kind of a preparatory reaction where coenzyme A is bound to the fatty acid, and that requires an ATP. So to start beta oxidation, it's almost like the beginning of glycolysis. It takes a little energy for it to get started. So now you have your coenzyme attached to the fatty acid, right? And then it becomes oxidized. And then finally, this carbon right here, okay, so here is the alpha carbon, here's the beta carbon. This beta carbon, we started off with two hydrogens, and we end up with this one carbonyl group right here. That's an oxidation step. So that's why we call this beta oxidation. This is the beta carbon in the fatty acid eventually becomes oxidized. And when it does, right, when this carbon becomes oxidized, what else has to happen? Another molecule has to be reduced, right? And the molecules that are reduced in this beta oxidation step is one FADH2, right, and one NADH. And of course, every FADH2 will produce two ATP when these electrons are given to electron transport, and NADH right here is going to produce three ATP. All right, so that's just before even acetyl-CoA goes into the Krebs cycle. So this two-carbon group goes into the Krebs cycle, and that produces some substrate-level ATP and what? Three more NADHs and one more FADH2. So until this fatty acid is completely metabolized, right? If this was a 20-carbon fatty acid, then this cycle right here is going to happen 9 times. Right? So this first step here wouldn't count, and then this would happen 9 more times, producing all these acetyl-CoAs and all these other NADHs. And where this happens is inside the matrix of the mitochondria, so no energy is lost with these FADHs or NADHs, FADH2s or NADHs inside the matrix. So beta oxidation can also produce hundreds of ATP for every fatty acid. And under what conditions does this take place? And why is that? So we should analyze under what conditions does this take place and why. Beta oxidation, that's a really good term. That's kind of a loaded term. It's called that because this beta carbon becomes oxidized. Okay, but what about Krebs cycle? Under what conditions does the Krebs cycle operate? Aerobic conditions, right? And these FADH2s and NADHs and all the FADH2s and NADHs produced by the Krebs cycle will only transfer their electrons to ETC under aerobic conditions, right? So beta oxidation happens under aerobic conditions, not anaerobic conditions as well. All right, so your body can gain a lot of ATP by beta oxidation of fatty acids. Oh, that's the last slide for this particular chapter. Okay, so for a long-chain fatty acid, right, we're talking hundreds of ATP, as opposed to glucose, which is like, what, a little less than 40 ATP. Okay, got the sign-in sheet right here. We'll keep it on the front desk maybe, or pass it around the room to make sure that everybody can sign the sign-in sheet. All right, so we're moving on to Chapter 7, the nervous system. It's kind of a long chapter, very interesting chapter. Probably learn some pretty good stuff in here. The first part is just a little bit of a review. So we're going to talk about some cells of the nervous system, and then we're going to get into some electrophysiology, like membrane potentials, and how neurons can use membrane potentials and other kinds of potentials to transmit information and to integrate information up in your body. All right, so remember, the nervous system can be broken down into two main areas, right? The central nervous system, which is made out of the brain and spinal cord, versus the peripheral nervous system, which is everything outside the brain and spinal cord, so that would be starting with cranial nerves and spinal nerves in the periphery. Furthermore, we can break down the cells that make up nervous tissue into two kinds. They're all going to be nervous system cells, but there's going to be two different kinds. There's going to be neurons that transmit electrical information, and then they're going to be supporting cells that we call glial cells or neuroglia or neuroglial cells. These don't transmit electrical information very fast, but they help support the job that these neurons are doing. All right, so we think that neurons are the functional units within the nervous system because they're gathering and transmitting information. All right, the glial cells maintain homeostasis. All right, so they help the neurons do their job, and there are many, many more of them, maybe 5 times as many glial cells as neurons. So for a long time, people were only interested in neurons because these were the cells that were transmitting information. And then now recently, everybody's very interested in glial cells because we've begun to understand the job that they are doing. For instance, glial cells tell neurons how to make a network, which neuron should be communicating with other kinds of neurons. So it determines the architecture of the network, which basically means how the nervous system is controlling everything in your body and maintaining homeostasis. All right, so we want to look at different types of neurons and different types of neuroglia cell. All right, so neurons gather and transmit information by being sensitive to stimuli. They respond to stimuli. They can produce and send electrochemical impulses very fast throughout the body, and they can release chemical messengers in the body. So this is what a typical neuron looks like. All right, we have the major part of the cell, which we call the cell body or the soma. It's got some processes sticking out of it right here that are short but highly branched. These are dendrites. And then there's typically one long axon or process, and this axon could be, maybe a meter or 2 meters long. So even though this is a microscopic structure, this axon is, vastly long compared to any other dimension of the cell. All right, so here we have the nucleus. And whenever you think of a neuron, information flows in one direction. It flows from a dendrite into the cell body and then down an axon. So here we see this little arrow right here that represents the direction of the impulse conduction down an axon. And the dendrites and cell body right here are what we call the receiving end of a neuron. Dendrites and soma, the receiving end, and the axon right here is the sending end. So you can make a little line of demarcation right here at the axon hillock. And that axon hillock kind of is acting like a funnel from taking information from all these dendrites in the cell body and funneling it right into this axon. All right, so this kind of axon is what we call a multipolar neuron. And the one down below it is another neuron. And this is what we call a unipolar neuron. We just have one process coming out. We don't see dendrites over here. All right, and this neuron right here functions as a sensory neuron. So these are going to be the dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. This is going to carry electrical information toward the central nervous system. So sensory, remember, is a way of bringing information from the periphery into the central nervous system. These cell bodies of this unipolar neuron are what we find in the dorsal root ganglia, spinal nerves. And then this right here is called the central process because this axon actually enters the central nervous system. So this axon partly exists in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. This multipolar neuron can be used as an interneuron for integrating information completely within the central nervous system, but it's also used as a motor neuron. All right, so this axon would leave the one root of the spinal cord going out into the periphery. And remember, roots are just one-way streets. You have a dorsal root and a ventral root. And so this motor neuron right here would leave the ventral root and go out into the periphery. Well, this central process of the unipolar neuron would go in the dorsal root of the spinal cord. Okay. The cell body makes everything that this cell needs, including neurotransmitters. And if we have a group of these someplace in the central nervous system, we would call that a nucleus, right? So if you have thousands of nerve cell bodies in some part of the central nervous system, we would call that a nucleus. And if we find a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, we would call that a ganglion, right? Like the dorsal root ganglion has thousands of these cell bodies of this unipolar neuron right here. The other cell that we see are these things that are wrapping around the axon. These are glial cells, and they're a special kind of glial cell. These are Schwann cells. And these Schwann cells make a compound called myelin, which is a fatty material, so it kind of looks yellowish or whitish. So if there's a group of axons going someplace in the body, we call that white matter because they are myelinated. Right, when a part of the neuron is not myelinated, it's not going to have a white appearance, it's going to have a gray appearance. And so we would call that gray matter. So a nucleus and a ganglion are gray matter. A nucleus in the central nervous system looks gray, as opposed to other parts of the central nervous system or brain look white because they're made up of these myelinated axons right here. Okay, so we said dendrites receive information, axons transmit information. And the big reason is, and I'll tell you, and then we'll have to look at this in some detail, there are different membrane components. All right, so different proteins in dendrites and cell body compared to axons and axon terminals. The dendrites receive information because they have receptors, right? And these receptors are coupled to ion channels. We call these ligand-gated channels. Right, so a receptor is a protein in the membrane, and when it binds a signaling molecule that binds to receptors, what do we call a ligand? A ligand is just a small molecule that binds to a bigger protein someplace in the body. Right, and when a signaling molecule binds to that receptor, it opens up an ion channel. Now, what can you tell me about the resting state of this cell right here? Is it at electrical neutrality? Or if it's a healthy cell, what can you tell me about the voltage across the membrane?
-70.
Yeah, it's -70 on the inside, right? And then we would say 0 on the outside compared to the outside right here. All right, now on the outside of the cell, what ion is at high concentration outside the cell? Can you remember from the last test? Sodium. And what kind of ion is sodium? Yeah, it's a plus. It's a cation, right? It's a monovalent cation. So it's negative inside the cell and compared to the outside. And you have high sodium, which has a positive charge on the outside. And if all of a sudden a channel for sodium opens up, what's going to happen to sodium? Is it going to want to move?
Yes.
Okay, it's going to want to move for two reasons, right? Because the inside of the cell is negative. Sodium is positive, so opposite charges want to neutralize each other, but also because the concentration gradient is going to draw sodium inside the cell. So when a ligand binds to this channel, opens up the channel, right, then the voltage on this cell changes drastically because sodium can enter, right, and the membrane potential goes away. And that is the basis of electrical signals, right, developed by axons, right, by these dendrites and cell bodies. So dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels that change their state. They open up when they bind a signaling molecule. Now the axon over here has different kinds of proteins in the membrane, not ligand-gated channels, but other kinds of channels. As signaling molecules bind to ligand-gated channels, that changes the voltage of dendrites and the cell body right here. That voltage sweeps over the whole cell and it runs into the axon hillock, and there's another kind of protein in the membrane right here that we call a voltage-gated channel. This channel is opened or closed depending on the voltage across the membrane. So that if these dendrites and cell body right here, if they depolarize because of the binding of ligands, when that voltage reaches this area of the axon, that's going to open more sodium channels, changing the electricity, the electrical properties of the axon, all right, and that's going to start an electrical impulse down the axon. So the reason why dendrites and cell body are the receiving end is because they have ligand-gated channels, and axons are the sending part of an axon because they have voltage-gated channels. So we're going to talk about that for the next couple of days. So that's just kind of a definition that I want you to memorize, and you'll get a feel for why that happens in a little bit. So two different kinds of channels. Other things that happen in neurons that don't have anything to do with electrical activity have to do with just transport or flow of material down the axon. There's something called exoplasmic flow. This moves soluble compounds toward the nerve endings via contractions of the axon, kind of almost like peristalsis, right? So this axon right here, there's going to be a wave of peristalsis that moves things from the cell body all the way down to this axon terminal over here. And that's a relatively slow process, okay? Because remember, this axon is extremely long. It could be a meter long. Right, and that's in distinction to axonal transport, as opposed to axoplasmic flow, which is just bulk transport of soluble materials. There's also axonal transport. And there are a couple kinds of axonal transport. These primarily move large and insoluble compounds, and it can happen in both directions. Okay, it can go from the cell body down to the axon terminus, or it can go from the axon terminus up to the cell body. And so how can you remember from anatomy how things usually can be moved around inside the cell? What system is inside the cell for moving things around? Like what positions a vesicle inside the cell? What moves a vesicle from the Golgi body over to the cell membrane for secretion? Or what moves chromosomes around during mitosis? Yeah, the microtubule system, right? It's just a little monorail system. So there are materials, okay, that can attach themselves to microtubules that run up and down the axons. And there are two different flows. Antegrade means going in the forward direction. Antegrade means moving things away from the cell body to the tip of a dendrite or the tip of an axon. And the opposite direction, you could say, is the reverse or backward flow, but a better term would be retrograde. Retrograde really means backward. Right, so this moves material from the axon terminus back up to the cell body, and these might be some signaling molecules or other kinds of things. Right, and the proteins that can attach themselves to the microtubules to make this transport work, right, for antegrade, they're called kinesins. These are little motor proteins that grab onto the microtubule system that move in the antegrade direction. The retrograde direction uses a little bit different kind of protein that's called a dynein. And this kind of motion is faster than exoplasmic flow. As a matter of fact, some toxins and viruses can enter the central nervous system by this retrograde transport system using dynein molecules. As far as the overall architecture of the nervous system is concerned, I think we talked about this in anatomy pretty much, right? If you have, and remember, a neuron can only transmit information in one direction, right? And the two directions are either sensory or motor, not both at the same time. And other proper terminology would be for sensory, that would be afferent. For motor, that would be efferent, right? Okay. And of course, I'm accentuating the pronunciation of afferent. That's really afferent and efferent. But that's just so that you can hear me pretty clearly. So here we have a typical sensory neuron, which is what, a bipolar neuron. And is this afferent or efferent? It is afferent, right, because this is a typical sensory neuron. And then here we have a multipolar neuron, like a typical somatic motor neuron. This would be an efferent neuron, right? And then there are some neurons that are found completely within the central nervous system that's not shown on this slide right here. And maybe in a bisynaptic reflex, we're going to find a multipolar neuron right within the white matter of the spinal cord right here, or gray matter of the spinal cord right here. So the only kind of neuron that is completely enclosed by the central nervous system would be a multipolar neuron. And sometimes those we call interneurons or association neurons. And these are important for integrating and even sharing information from one side of the body to the other. All right, so hopefully this is a nice review from anatomy. I do want you to know these types of neurons right here and what their function is. So we got the unipolar, we got a bipolar, and a multipolar. The function of a unipolar is sensory. Sometimes we call that pseudo-unipolar, but these are sensory neurons, right? So these are afferent neurons. These multipolar neurons right here are motor neurons, or they can be association neurons inside the central nervous system. And these bipolar neurons right here are always going to be associated with some special senses, like vision and hearing, for instance. Okay, that's the only place where we would find these. Okay, support cells. Didn't talk too much about support cells in anatomy. And basically, support cells are different whether they're found in the peripheral nervous system or central nervous system. We're going to break it down into two categories. So here we have a nice multipolar neuron. Here's the axon coming out of it. And wrapped around this axon right here is a Schwann cell. A Schwann cell produces myelin, which is a lipid material, and it acts like insulation, so electrical activity can't move out of the axon, and that just concentrates the electrical activity inside this axon. All right, this last part of the Schwann cell that's wrapped around right here, this is what we call the neurolemma that contains the cytoplasm, but these inner layers right here just contain myelin. But notice that these Schwann cells don't form a continuous sheath over this axon. There are breaks in the sheath that we call nodes of Ranvier. And these nodes of Ranvier have voltage-gated channels. And when an axon is myelinated, like what we have right here, that speeds the velocity of the impulse down the axon. So it makes an axon a lot faster if it's myelinated. So that's an advantage in our nervous systems because most of our neurons are myelinated neurons. All right, so this is a satellite cell, a Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system that is supporting the job of this multipolar neuron. I'll have to talk some more about that a little bit later on. But this just shows basically how a Schwann cell wraps itself around and it squishes finally the cytoplasm out into this very last layer right here, and that's what we call the neurilemma. And it acts as insulation. Like all the wires in your house, or most of the wires in your house, would you guess, do they have insulation around them or not?
No.
Absolutely. You'd never want to plug something in that doesn't have insulation because then the electricity would go into you, right? Okay. Let me just say, in the peripheral nervous system, there's another kind of support cell, which I guess I don't have a picture of, right? But I can tell you where they are. So here we have a sensory neuron. This body right here, the cell body, is going to be located in the dorsal root ganglion, right, of a root going into the spinal cord. And surrounding every cell body will be a score of what we call satellite cells that will surround this cell body right here and protect it from other nerve cell bodies of its neighbors. All right, and the dorsal root ganglia is really part of the peripheral nervous system. So there are two important kinds of neuroglia cells in the peripheral nervous system. There are ones that make a myelin sheath around an axon and others that surround the cell bodies in a dorsal root ganglia, and those we would call satellite cells. Okay, so we got Schwann and satellite cells are the two kinds. Now, in the central nervous system, we have more kinds of support cells, and here's a list of them: oligodendrocytes, microglia, astrocytes, and ependymal cells. And I'm sure this is an exam figure. I'm not so concerned that you know the structure of these things, right? I'm concerned that you understand the functions of these various kinds of neuroglia cells. So this might be an exam figure, but not only do you have to recognize them by shape, but you should also know their function as well. So let's maybe go over some of these functions. Okay, first off, we see a nice multipolar neuron right here colored in that kind of gold, and you can see that it has a myelin sheath wrapped around it as well with some nodes of Ranvier between the sheaths. The cell that makes myelin sheath around an axon in the central nervous system is not a Schwann cell, it's a different kind, it's an oligodendrocyte. And in the peripheral nervous system, each one of these little insulations right here is a single cell, but in the central nervous system, one oligodendrocyte can make various wrappings in different locations on an axon, and it can even put a myelin sheath on different neurons, neighboring neurons, right? And the oligodendrocyte is not a pathway for sharing information, as far as we know at this point in time, because it's what? An insulator. It doesn't allow for electrical information to transfer from one cell to the other, but we might learn that there might be some chemical messages being sent via this bridge. All right, so oligodendrocyte, you would want to say where? Central nervous system, right? Central nervous system. There are these little microglia cells, and a microglia cell kind of looks like a dendritic cell or a Langerhans cell in the epidermis, if you can remember all the way back to the integument of your anatomy class, and these are immunological cells. So they move by diapedesis. They're shapeshifters crawling around inside our central nervous system looking for things that don't belong: dead cells, viruses, bacteria, fungi, or other kinds of things, right? So that protects our brain from infection. And the ependymal cells, these are the cells that line the ventricles inside the brain. Some ependymal cells are combined with capillaries that are very leaky to produce cerebral spinal fluid in the ventricles, but it also acts as a little bit of a barrier to prevent things that are in the ventricles of the brain from actually having access to these neurons right here. All right, so sometimes these things will make The choroid plexus, that's where cerebral spinal fluid is made, but it also just acts like an epithelium that lines the ventricles inside the brain, even though they're really nervous tissue. And you can kind of see, well, what kind of epithelium does that look like? Yeah, it kind of looks like a simple cuboidal, maybe a little bit of a columnar, but simple cuboidal. Okay, and then the last cell right here, this astrocyte, named after, it reminded somebody of what a star looks like up in the sky with all these light rays coming out of it. Okay, the astrocyte we're learning more and more about all the time, and it's becoming very important. We see that it has processes that we call perivascular feet attached to this capillary right here. And what can you tell me about a capillary? Maybe by just the structure. We see that it is a simple squamous endothelium, which means it's what? It's kind of leaky, right? It's this kind of epithelium is there for exchange between the blood and the central nervous system, all right? And sometimes that's not really such a good thing because there might be harmful compounds in the blood that are going to disrupt the function of these neurons right here, right? And so this astrocyte makes a barrier between the blood and the brain. And so we call that the blood-brain barrier. So not all drugs, for instance, can leave the blood and go to the brain. And so if somebody is interested in making a particular kind of pharmaceutical compound that is going to have activity on these neurons in the brain, they also have to figure out a way to get it through the blood-brain barrier, right? They have to engineer that into the molecule. So blood-brain barrier is another important, is one important function of an astrocyte. But we see also that it can form a bridge between this capillary and the neuron. So maybe it can selectively take up glucose and deliver it directly to the cell via active transport or other kinds of compounds like amino acids. So astrocytes act as a special delivery system. All right, astrocytes also maintain the chemical environment around this neuron. Like, for instance, what ion should be high in this extracellular space right here? Sodium and chloride, right? So this astrocyte helps maintain that electrical or that ionic balance of the extracellular fluid to make the electrical properties of this neuron behave. Neurons communicate with each other not directly by electrical impulses, but by chemical signals that we call neurotransmitters. And astrocytes can also degrade or take up neurotransmitters so that those transmitters have a short duration of action when stimulating or communicating with another neuron. All right, so we would call that uptake of neurotransmitters. So astrocytes sometimes take up those signaling molecules so that a neuron doesn't become overstimulated or overexcited. And this is this last thing that I'm going to talk about is pretty fascinating. The other thing that astrocytes do is that they sometimes secrete growth factors. Now, you probably all know that when somebody has a spinal cord injury, for instance, how quickly does somebody recover from a spinal cord injury? Almost never, right? Because these neurons in the central nervous system do not regenerate, right? And so that's the assumption that we work with for a long, long time. But just like other parts of your body, for instance, if you were to walk around all day with a 5-pound weight and exercise your biceps, what would happen to your biceps muscle? It would grow and get bigger. It would respond to that stress. All right, the same thing for the bones of that arm, right? Bone is a living tissue. If you stress those bones, they get bigger and stronger as well. All right, and recently we have learned that there are factors secreted from astrocytes that if you use your brain, these things will secrete growth factors that will actually promote not only maybe the development of new neurons, but it will also promote how neurons interact, connect up with each other. So there are more synapses, and those connections are what we call synapses. So a person's brain is changing all the time and responding to their environment because these astrocytes right here are making new connections and new neurons in your brain as a result. Those are called brain-derived neurotrophic factors. And so the architecture of our brain actually changes as we learn new kinds of information. And I'm sure everybody's brain is a lot different after an anatomy class than it was before. And your brain is probably going to be a lot different structurally after a physiology class than before. All right, so probably it's a good idea to be aware of that, because your brain modifies itself to respond to the kinds of stimuli that you allow into it. Right, so careful on what kind of stimuli you allow into your brain, because it's changing. And one of the jobs of the brain, one of the most important jobs of the brain, what it likes to do more than anything else, I should actually ask this as a question. What does the brain like to do more than anything else? Okay, you're thinking, that's kind of a hint, but it actually likes to learn, right? The brain always likes to learn, and then these astrocytes help the remodeling of the brain so that it can learn more efficiently in that particular mode. And that's very important clinically, because there are certain pathologies that we all know are harmful to somebody, for instance, like epilepsy. Okay, when somebody has a seizure, it starts in the brain and then it produces muscle spasms in the periphery, right? And those kinds of processes have to be treated very aggressively, because, of course, we all know that a convulsion doesn't help the individual, but the brain really doesn't know that. And when the brain goes into uncontrolled electrical, when it's sending uncontrolled electrical messages, the brain actually learns how to produce epileptic fits. Okay, so if somebody has 10 or 20 or 30 seizures, epileptic seizures, it's very difficult to treat, because the brain has actually learned how to produce those seizures. All right, if somebody has one, and then with aggressive treatment we prevent those seizures from recurring again, the brain hasn't learned how to produce the seizures, and the treatment is much more effective. Okay, and that's the same for other kinds of diseases, for instance, like clinical depression. The brain actually learns how to make somebody clinically depressed, and so that's another pathology that should be treated very aggressively as well. All right, somebody that has many episodes of depression typically are hard to treat. But if it's treated early on successfully, then the person can live a really nice, happy, normal life. Okay, because the brain likes to learn, because of these, one of the reasons is because these astrocytes are telling neurons how to connect up with each other. Okay, here are these oligodendrocytes for producing myelin sheaths in the central nervous system. Okay, and all right, I think most of this we kind of talked about already, except for nerve regeneration. In the peripheral nervous system, nerve regeneration certainly happens much more readily than in the central nervous system. So if a axon is cut, okay, then this proximal end right here degenerates, right, because you have immune cells that clean up all of this debris right here. And then there are progenitor cells from these Schwann cells form a tube, which we call a regeneration tube, all the way to this effector organ, and the axon grows through the regeneration tube to re-innervate an organ right here. So, for instance, maybe you've had some kind of surgery on some part of the body, maybe face or whatever, and for maybe 4 or 5 months you don't have any feeling in one side of your face, and then, you know, it just might eventually come back as these nerves regenerate and reinnervate the sensory organs in your face. Okay. Neurotrophins, that's what I just talked about, for important for regeneration. These neurotrophins are especially important for fetal nerve growth, but also for remodeling even an adult's nervous system. Very, very important. Okay, and I think I mentioned at the astrocytes what they do. Now, I didn't mention one particular kind of neurotransmitter. For instance, glutamate is a neurotransmitter, and once it's released into the synaptic cleft, this astrocyte can take it up, right, and preventing continual stimulus of the postsynaptic cell, and it can then actually recycle it back into the axon. Blood-brain barrier we talked about. All right, so that's going to take us to membrane potential. So I want you to know those three kinds of neurons, what their function is, and all those different kinds of neuroglia, where they're found, central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, and what their functions are. And next time, we're going to start with resting membrane potential. Okay. Okay, don't forget the sign-in sheet. Hi.